Good morning. This begins the broadcast day. I'll start over. Good morning. This begins the live broadcast day for Free Radio Santa Cruz. 101.3 on the FM dial. Streaming live at freakradio.org. Go to our main web page and click on the listen link and follow the instructions to hear our online stream.
Sogno all'orizzonte, mancano le parole. Sì, lo so che non c'è luce in una stanza quando manca il sole. Se non ci sei tu con me su le finestre, mostra a tutti il mio cuore che hai acceso. Chiudi dentro me la luce che hai incontrato per strada. Con te partirò paesi che non ho mai veduto e vissuto con. Adesso sì, li vivrò con te. Partirò su navi per mari che io lo so non esistono più. Con te io li vivrò. Quando sei lontana sogno all'orizzonte, mancano le parole. E io solo so che sei con me, tu mia luna, tu sei qui con me. Io solo tu sei qui con me.
Andrea Bocelli, yeah, he's from Italy. I have that music going through my head every day from the album Romanza. 1996. Romanza. Yeah, between Dr. Mike and myself, we get that aired quite a bit. Good morning and welcome. This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. It is 11:06 in the morning. 11:06 a.m. this Saturday, April 11, 2015. And if that jives with your own personal time-space continuum, then you know the show is live. However, if you are inclined to communicate by calling into the studio, that can only be done in a small window of time. I'm used to telling people about halfway through the program, in an hour or 50 minutes from now, I will take your calls. We'll do it a little bit differently. This morning, I'll take your calls starting in about a half hour, at around 11:40. If you do not wish to... If you do not wish to call in to discuss the material that I'll be presenting or say anything else on your mind, preferably about the immediate matter of Israelis and Palestinians, that aspect of the Middle East conflict, then you can always send an email to this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's just one dot. I stuttered. MideastMadness@G as in George, M as in Machiavellian, X as in xylophone.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. This is the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio. Saturday editions of the Mideast Migraine program are dedicated, have been for about a year and a half now, to the readings of important current or almost current books regarding Palestinians, Israelis, Jews, Arabs, Muslims, Christians, and what the whole hubbub is about. My interest in doing this and presenting this to you lies entirely in the fact, at least historically, it lies in the fact that I am of Palestinian extraction myself. My father was a native-born Jerusalem Christian, as was his whole family. Or at least I know Dad was born in Jerusalem. Good old Jerusalem, as he liked to say. While we were passing through the Canadian border once, we are right about smack in the middle of the book entitled Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories by Anna Baltzer. The book is copyrighted 2007, although this edition is updated and revised as of 2014, just last year. There are, for those who have not been introduced to the reading yet or to the book itself on your own time, let me just give you, there are many, many, profuse number of reviews here or snippets from reviews. I'll read a couple. From Professor Kenneth Ring, editor of Letters from Palestine, Anna Baltzer's groundbreaking book, Witness in Palestine, is one of the most comprehensive, moving, and informative accounts of daily life for Palestinians living under the Israeli occupation. With vivid photographs to complement her riveting text, Baltzer's outstanding and handsomely produced book is a must-read for anyone who wants to know what is really going on in the Holy Land. Ali Abunima, the infamously madman of Electronic Intifada and author of One Country, A bold proposal to end the Israeli-Palestinian impasse. Ali says Balzer has a true passion to educate and act for justice in Palestine. Dr. Salman Abu Sita, former member of the Palestinian National Council and founder of the Palestine Land Society. Dr. Abu Sita, eloquent, sincere, and powerful. Here is a single paragraph in review of the book from a friend of mine whom I met in the summer of 2008. This woman is a Holocaust survivor. Thankfully for her, she never personally encountered the direct circumstances. She was sent away as a young child so that she would be saved. So in that sense, was a Holocaust survivor. Hedy Epstein of St. Louis, Missouri. Her intention was to sail with us from Larnaca, Cyprus to the Gaza Strip. Unfortunately, at the last moment, Hedy was not able to make the trip with us. But here is Eddie's Hedy Epstein, lifelong human rights and social justice activist, her comment: this book is about the thousands of ordinary Palestinian people who just want to live their lives like anybody else. Using her camera as a paintbrush, Balzer manages, through a series of snapshots and narratives, to capture not only the Israeli government's policies and military practices working to destroy Palestinian society, but also the resilience and dignity of the Palestinian people resisting the occupation. We'll get one or two more here comments to whet your appetite. Rebecca Vilcomerson, the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace. Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine has been a crucial reference work for me for many years. Well-written, thorough, and searingly detailed, its words, maps, and photos are an extraordinary resource for learning and teaching about what is happening in Palestine. Entirely rooted in what she has seen with her own eyes, with a deep respect for the reader's process of discovery, it nevertheless blazes with her passion for justice. Through her example, and that of so many courageous Palestinians, Israelis, and international activists that are described in the book, it is also an inspiring call to action. Rebecca Vilcomerson, of JVP. Okay. Since those review snippets have made a number of references to the stylishness and the many photographs and pictures and maps in the book, obviously one can only truly realize the wonder and the beauty and the importantness of it if you were to get your own copy. Go to ParadigmPublishers.com. That's P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M Publishers, ParadigmPublishers.com of Boulder, Colorado, to find out how you can get your own copy. I'm almost positive you can buy one for cheap or relatively cheap at Amazon, Amazon.com. Check out your favorite bookstore. And again, the book is entitled Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories, updated and revised, first published 2007. Stand by, please.
Yesterday. E sono sempre in mezzo ai guai. Vivo e ti domando cosa sei. Ma specchio, tu non parli mai. Io che io non potrò mai creare niente. Io amo l'amore, ma non la gente. Io che non sarò mai un dio. Vivere, nessuno mai ce l'ha insegnato. Vivere, fotocopiandoci il passato.
Tu vedessi l'uomo davanti al tuo portone che dorme avvolto in un cartone.
Okay. Doing a last minute preparation to prepare my throat for this weekly exercise. Now, Anna Balzer strings the stories in this book together, not merely through standard nonfiction chapters, but as a series of separate journal entries. As I said, we're about halfway through the book. We've been at this for roughly 3 months. I'll tell you later about how you can receive podcasts of my readings of the book so that you may catch up. If not, simply go to the library or bookstore or otherwise order the book for yourself. There are some really fantastic, super high quality color photos, maps, and even children's drawings, which really flesh out the story of the Palestinians under occupation. This is the entry, Friday, April 15, 2005, almost 10 years ago to the day. Last week we spoke of the time spent under occupation during Easter, the Christian Easter. April 15 entry, 2005, back to Safa and reflections on symbolism. Here we go, Witness in Palestine by Anna Balzer. I'll set this up with a paragraph from the preceding chapter. Imam and her friends were ready to return to the village. Amy and I felt drained, and the only demonstrators left were young boys throwing stones. We decided to leave with Enam, who led us up the long hike uphill to the village. She invited us in for bread with olive oil and spices, and introduced us to the children she takes care of, children of her siblings who have been killed, arrested, or sent abroad. She took our phone numbers and promised to call the next time Safa held a demonstration. Now the chapter, Back to Safa and Reflections on Symbolism. Enam kept her promise. She called me a few weeks later to request an IWPS presence at another protest in Safa. This time we were fewer, but better prepared. We reached the bulldozers before the soldiers did and sat down in front of the machines, hoping their drivers would stop out of fear of hurting someone. When we refused to move, soldiers threw sound bombs and we sprang up out of fear. One bomb exploded in my face, ricocheting off my neck and blasting my eardrum. For a moment, I was sure I'd lost hearing in my right ear. Again, these are the words of Ms. Anna Balzer, American Jew. My ear was still ringing when the explosion stopped. The protesters were scattered. An old man had fallen and slashed his hand and was being carried away. We regrouped and walked back together towards the machines, resolved not to stop until we were physically beaten down. The soldiers drew their batons and began beating demonstrators left and right. I fumbled with my camera to catch the violence on film. It was mostly an excuse not to move forward with the others. I was paralyzed with fear of being beaten. Our numbers were too few to move past the soldiers' batons, so we sat down again, as close to the bulldozers as possible to prevent them from working. The bulldozer operator saw us and decided to teach us a lesson. Using the bulldozer's claw, he gathered hundreds of pounds of rocks and dirt and began moving towards us. The soldiers yelled at us to move, and we scurried away just before the claw covered our ground with rubble. The bulldozer operator's manifest. The bulldozer operator's manifest indifference to us was disheartening, to say the least. Much of nonviolent resistance relies on the awakening of people's consciences. We sat down away from the bulldozers to observe and film. If we couldn't stop the destruction, at least we would document it. Everyone remained seated except a few children who sprang up to place a Palestinian flag above the growing pile of rubble formed by the bulldozer. Each time the machine knocked it over with more rubble, they would dig it up and put it back. The old farmer had somehow reached his land during the chaos of sound bombs and tear gas, perhaps because the soldiers were distracted. The soldiers spotted him a few minutes after I did, and they told him to leave. Sitting peacefully on a rock, he declared that they would have to kill him first. They left him alone. He wasn't worth their trouble. He sat among his trees all afternoon. He had no M16 rifle and no army, but like the children raising the flag, his peaceful determination was stronger than any gun. The Israeli army has wrecked continuous havoc on Palestinian land and life, but it has never succeeded in destroying the Palestinian spirit. Nothing will stop humans from seeking freedom, least of all guns. Firearms don't bring security or peace to anyone. I watch soldiers clutch the massive things, and I see that they are so scared, so completely terrified. And next to them are the unarmed activists, so free because they have neither a heavy gun nor a heavy conscience weighing them down. I have started using a new strategy for talking to soldiers. At first, I ignore them because they don't have any legitimate authority over me or anyone else in the area. But if they engage me and begin to ask me questions, I politely tell them that I don't feel comfortable talking to someone with a big gun in his hands. I invite them to put down their guns and talk, but they never do. Israeli soldiers aren't the only ones attached to their guns. One of the first things I noticed in Palestine was the prevalence of toy guns in the hands of children in the street. It didn't surprise me that they would want to play with guns. After all, the people they see in power every day, the soldiers and settlers, all have guns. But it surprised me that their parents would allow it, since most families I met are basically peaceful. For example, a friend of mine who advocates nonviolent resistance won't let his sons throw stones at demonstrations, but he lets them pose with guns and pictures. It seems crazy to me. Aren't guns about killing? I don't like guns. I hate seeing them everywhere here, on posters of people killed by soldiers and in plastic replicas in corner stores. But I have struggled to understand their presence instead of just reacting to it. To me, guns symbolize violence and fear. But to many Palestinians, they symbolize strength. For a Palestinian to have a gun on his or her death poster means that he or she was brave instead of submissive, no matter what the cause of death. Guns aren't a Palestinian tradition any more than they are a Jewish one. The Zapatistas in Mexico carved out wooden guns as symbols of their struggle, too. It's about honor, not killing. And honor is very important to people here. It's what they have left as their rights and land slip away. It's interesting how symbols begin to mean some different things to me here. On my wrist, I wear a wristband that says Palestine with a Palestinian flag in the background. It was a gift, and I like the way it looks. I like wearing it because it shows clearly my solidarity with Palestinians when I'm in the West Bank, and it sparks interest. It sparks interest in conversations with Israelis in Israel. But it has a flag on it, and I've always avoided flags and other symbols of nationalism. Is this one any different? I struggle to justify this contradiction. The Palestinian flag is different from most. It was illegal for many years and to me represents more the struggle for freedom and nationhood than the nation itself. Being in Palestine is a lesson in maturity and flexibility for me. On the one hand, I am learning to make judgments and take sides on issues I used to discuss as complicated. On the other hand, issues like stone throwing, flag waving, and gun toting are not as black and white as they used to be. They have always been clear. There have always been clear categories and rules in my life. Suddenly, there are none. For the first time in my life, I have to decide for myself what is right and what is wrong. The other night, a colleague and I snuck out to spray paint over anti-Arab graffiti that settlers had sprayed in Hebrew on an old roadblock near Haris. I used to dislike vandalism, but I had no trouble spraying a big flower around the words, rendering them illegible. Yet another lesson of wrong becoming right. Besides, we have to do something for fun around here. There's a photograph of a flower spray painted by IWPS volunteers over offensive Hebrew or Jewish language graffiti on a roadblock in Haris. I can see the flower easily enough. It's almost impossible for me to make out any of the other black paint lines. Another photograph of a yellow curb on the side of a road. Hebrew graffiti near Zatara checkpoint reads, "Death to Arabs on the curb and revenge on the bus stop." Checkpoint. The checkpoint, of course, being an official Israeli occupation forces checkpoint dedicated to making the lives of the Palestinians who live under occupation very miserable. Let's continue with the reading. That is the end of this journal entry, by the way. We have to do something for fun around here. Next entry, Monday, April 18, 2005. Israeli attacked by settlers. You heard me right. This says, an Israeli attacked by settlers. Strange, because the settlers spoken of throughout this book are exclusively Jewish. Let's see what that's about. Yesterday, I made the mistake of going to the dentist. One of my phobias. The fear aroused in me released a flood of emotions that had been building over the last few months. Out came feelings of anger and sorrow that I had been suppressing for fear that they might interfere with my work here. Out came uncertainties about my work based on reactions I've received from friends back home who feel my writing has become extremist, one-sided, and offensive. Criticism from friends is always hard for me to hear and has made me question what I'm doing here and whether my steps towards forming a more concrete and perhaps radical opinion about the situation here are doing more harm than good. My worries and emotions have put me in somewhat of a daze, but today woke me up. I went to accompany farmers plowing in Asuya with rabbis for human rights. Yesterday, several farmers were attacked on the village's land below the outpost. Outpost referring to an illegal Israeli settlement technically illegal even by Israeli law. Continuing now. One of the victims was my friend's mother, the one who had welcomed me warmly, fed me, and told me her story. Hannah was present during yesterday's incident and wrote about how the villagers, many of them back to plow on their land for the first time in 4 years, had gathered the courage to go that day because the army had promised them protection from settlers. But the soldiers came several hours late, by which time settlers had already come down, shoved and threatened the family, and kicked their donkey. Today was calmer than yesterday. We didn't see any settlers, which was not surprising since there weren't many Palestinians either. Either the absent farmers had managed to finish their plowing already, or they were too scared to come back. We split up to accompany the few farmers who were present, but my group had little to do, so we sat under a tree to talk, rest, and wait. It was an interesting group, an elderly British man named John from Christian Peacemaker Teams, an Israeli activist in his 40s named David, my friend Luna, and me. I began telling Luna about my recent insecurities about what I was doing, and pretty soon the four of us were engaged in a discussion about Zionism and the past 80 years of Israel-Palestine's history. John offered what struck me as a balanced account of the violence committed on both sides between the 1920s and 1970s, while David and Luna felt it was unproductive to focus on Arab violence because it was a reaction to the far greater crimes committed by early Zionists and the Israeli governments that followed. I found myself on John's side, saying that a massacre is a massacre, regardless of what was done to provoke it, and it's important to acknowledge the suffering on both sides, even if they are not equal. We all agreed, though, that it was not useful to see the past and present as just, quote, a complicated and ancient problem that can only be resolved through mutual respect and understanding. Israel is a superpower, using the fourth strongest military in the world and billions of American tax dollars per year to occupy and colonize Palestinian land while denying Palestinians basic human rights and civil liberties. Israelis are certainly also suffering to the extent that they fear terrorist attacks. But their fear is incomparable to the suffering of those living under the constant threat of death, imprisonment, and losing their homes or livelihoods. I don't think it is useful or fair to equate the two, or to be, quote, balanced, in speaking of the violence committed on both sides. And there is a footnote here following the declaration that Israel has the fourth strongest military in the world. It says, at the bottom of the page here, the International Institute of Strategic Studies estimated Israel's military strength to surpass that of all other countries except the United States, the The United States, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, now Russia, and China. International Institute of Strategic Studies estimation, October 11, 1982, in Time magazine. It says here, some Israelis rank themselves third, as cited in Chomsky, Fateful, page 6. Let us continue with the text of the book. I used to take every opportunity to tell Palestinians that most soldiers are committing crimes because they are afraid, not because they are evil. I wanted Palestinians to understand the soldiers and other Israelis, to feel their pain and respect it. But I no longer believe that peace will come simply from mutual understanding and friendship. There is no harm in introducing Palestinians to sympathetic Jews and Israelis, but the burden is not on them to make peace and open their hearts. Peace and reconciliation will begin when the forgotten or ignored injustices and atrocities are acknowledged and dealt with justly. At one point during our conversation under the olive tree, I realized that I had read about David before. He had been attacked in Yanun village, the site of frequent settler violence, and the place where I am headed tomorrow. David told me this story. After October 2002, it was clear that Yanun needed a constant presence of individuals or Israelis. I stayed in the village with other Israeli activists for a whole month, and then some internationals came in our stead, and we came up occasionally on Shabbat, when settlers were most known to attack. On Shabbat. One Saturday, I learned that the two internationals in the village had been kidnapped by Avri Ron, an extremely dangerous and influential local settler with an almost cult following, and one of his followers. The internationals were stripped of their shoes and jackets in the pouring rain and made to march through the outposts on plant needles and rocks. They were then forced to lie on the ground, face down in the mud, for a long time before Avri finally let them go. When I met them 2 days later, I learned that Avri had taken the camera of one international and thrown it on the ground near where they lay. It was a very expensive camera, and I suggested that we go up to the outpost to try and find it. The army agreed to accompany us. We combed the area, but there was no sign of the camera. As we were leaving, I saw Avri and his friend approaching. I immediately stood between them and the internationals, thinking that they might be more reluctant to hit me, a Jew, than the others. I was wrong. They beat me repeatedly with the butts of their rifles all over my body. The four soldiers who had accompanied us were a few meters away. They watched in silence. I tried to defend myself and remained standing, but at one point Avri got me full on the face, tearing my nose and crushing part of my skull. I cried out for the soldiers to help me, but they were afraid. I was bleeding profusely. David continues his testimony here. When Avri finally let me go, the soldiers walked with me down to the village. The settlers continued to throw stones at me, and I tried to dodge them. I was in the hospital for some time, and the next time I saw Avri and the soldiers was in court. The state was supposedly prosecuting Avri, but they didn't feel that way. Avri spoke with big eyes and words in a way that almost entranced the court. He is truly psychotic. He also must have amazing connections, because when I asked the prosecution about the photographs the army had taken of me and the other internationals after the incident, he didn't know what I was talking about. Apparently, the army had lost the photos. One of the international witnesses had written a sworn affidavit about the incident, which was also mysteriously dismissed. The only witnesses were me and the soldiers. Three soldiers flat out lied, denying that Avri had done anything. Only one soldier corroborated my story, but the judge didn't believe him and let Avri off. Avri has killed people in the past and is likely to do it again. He is very dangerous, but the justice system and army are protecting him and his followers. Sometimes I think he'll come to Tel Aviv and kill me or my son because I have tried to expose him. And there is a picture of David, or perhaps David, the Israeli activist who was beaten up by Israeli settlers in Yanun village. He's smiling. No indication of trauma or scars on his face, at least not the profile that I'm seeing. Let's continue with the text. I watched David as he spoke calmly and gently, smiling occasionally as he sat with his face in the sun. I couldn't imagine how anyone could ever want to hurt such a person. His scar is still visible along the left side of his nose. I'm just looking at his right profile here. But he's otherwise fine and sound. I don't think I could recover from such a traumatic experience with the patience and courage that he has exhibited. David maintains close friendships with many of the villagers in Yanun and was one of the first to hear about the most recent settler attack in Yanun 5 days ago. According to David's sources, as night was falling, four Palestinian men on a tractor were surrounded by six armed settlers who had dug a huge hole and piled up the extra dirt next to it. The settlers asked the villagers if they had cell phones, and they said no. The settlers then made the Palestinians stand behind the dirt pile so that they would be invisible from the road. Night fell. Suddenly, one Palestinian's phone rang. He had lied, and he went to answer it. A settler charged him, destroyed the phone, but could not be sure if the caller had heard anything or not. The settler called another group and told them not to come to do what they had planned. He wanted to abort the mission. The four Palestinians ran off into the darkness as fast as possible, back to their village. They and David suspect the settlers intended to kill and bury them in the darkness, leaving no trace of what had happened. Maybe that cell phone saved their lives. It was horrible to hear David and his friends' stories, but it brought things into focus. My writing is extreme. My writing is extreme because what is going on around me is extreme. My opinions cannot remain uninfluenced by what I've seen. Anyone who could remain neutral while witnessing such discrimination and injustice would have to be either amoral or insane. So I will acknowledge becoming increasingly radical, but I will not apologize for it. The nature of my writing is due to the reality it relates, not the way I wrote it. Picture at the top of the page of a fundamentalist settler in a yarmulke or a skull cap, tunic, and with a rifle, automatic rifle, threatening a Palestinian farmer harvesting her olives. The Palestinian farmer is an old or middle-aged woman shaking her fist at the settler who typically stands on higher ground than she. Again, I am reading from Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. I'm going to open up the phone lines now. I'm figuring that one possible reason why people are not inclined to call in, even when I ask them to, is because I wait until the show is half over, a good hour or so into the program, and they have either gone away or gone to sleep, lost interest. So please, it is 11:44 a.m. I probably should have started taking the calls earlier. If anyone out there is listening, please call in. Talk to me about what you're hearing. Talk to me about your ideas. As long as we keep calm and respectful, I will maintain the conversation for a reasonable length of time. Area code for both lines 1 and 2 is 831. That's 831 here in Santa Cruz County on the central coast of California. Line 1, 427-3772. Again, 427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. 469-3119. Area code 831. In the past, I'm not going to stop talking here probably, so just go ahead and make your call. In the past, recent past, I've asked people to volunteer their ideas about the direction this program is going. I've been doing the Mideast Migraines program here. Gee, I hope that's not the first time I said the name of the show today. Mideast Migraines with your host, Ren Tawil, on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I crave feedback from my listeners and from anyone interested in this subject matter about the direction that I should be going with this. Naturally, I have a tendency to say to myself, no news is good news. I may as well continue the way I've been going. On the other hand, it's as though no one is listening to the program, and I do not believe that that's the case. In fact, I know it is not the case that no one listens. But it sure feels pretty lonely with no dialogue, no feedback, no indication that this program has any purpose, constructive, detrimental, or otherwise. I'm not saying that I hope that I'm being detrimental here, but I can certainly imagine that there are those, and I've had a very small number of indications that this program pisses some people off. They hear it, perhaps for not more than a minute or two, and then move along to something else, move along down the dial, or find something else to do or to listen to. That is why it is important that I hear from all of you, no matter what your attitude towards me or this program or this subject matter is. I crave feedback from any listeners, regular listeners, first-time listeners, infrequent listeners, or otherwise. I see there are quite a few of you out there listening now online. That's always nice to see. Again, the phone number, area code 831, your choice of two, 427-3772, 427-3772. Line number two is 469-3119. That's 469-3119. Yes, usually I'm playing a bit of music while I'm waiting for the calls to come in. I'm taking the calls, offering to take them a little earlier so that I don't lose people in the later course of this two-hour program who might otherwise call in. And if I keep talking, I believe it will ensure people that I'm here, still here, and ready to take your call. Now, I mentioned earlier that these programs are available on podcast. They are, at least the ones that I managed to successfully record and transfer to the to my archives. We do have technical problems once in a while, and the recordings end up falling flat or just not working. So far, we seem to be recording pretty well. There are two online archives at two different websites. RadioForAll.net, that's RADIO, the digital number four, ALL.NET, RadioForAll.net. RadioForAll.net, go there and type Mideast Migraines into the search box, and you will immediately come up with a chronological listing of my shows, generally the most recent one at the top. Readings of Witness in Palestine are indicated by the letters, well, first, my name, it actually says Satren, Sat for Saturday, Ren for me. Satren, and the date is given. Then it will say WP for Witness in Palestine, and then the title of one of the chapters that I've read during that recording. Likewise, there is a second website. Let's see, Santa Cruz Media Center, Indy Bay. Santa Cruz, the name of the city where this program emanates from two words, S-A-N-T-A. Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z. Santa Cruz Indy Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, Indy Bay, Santa Cruz Media Center, Indy Bay. There is also an Indy Bay server for the San Francisco Bay Area and perhaps others. You want the Monterey Bay / Santa Cruz, or is it Santa Cruz / Monterey Bay Edition? Go there, look on the right side of the screen, the long vertical green box for Mideast Migraines entries. You may also click on the word Palestine in the left vertical green box, or whatever shade U it is. Click on the word Palestine. That may help you locate the programs. Generally, the RadioForAll.net website is the easiest to navigate through and find my programs at. And again, you may contact me by email. This radio program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's MideastMadness at G as in God, M as in mail, X as in Xerxes.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. And whoop. Now I appear to be losing a couple of listeners, probably because I'm not reading from the book. But I do want to pass along a couple of public service announcements here. As soon as I get to my inbox, won't take long. Yes, some of this stuff, the contents of Anna Balzer's book can be extremely hard to take. It's often difficult for me to get through reading it without wanting to react emotionally. As part of the stuff of this program, it should be the case for other Free Radio Santa Cruz programs. Our commitment to the community is to let you in on some interesting things, goings on, and tidbits like this. Ticket giveaway. Thanks to Matthew O'Connell here. Hello. We are having a Roots Reggae Showcase at the Blue Lagoon Bar in downtown Santa Cruz on Saturday, April 11. That's today, folks. We'd like to give away two tickets for entry to your listeners, to Free Radio listeners. The artists are Dre Z, Biblical, Duchesne from St. Croix, Lujan. Please let me know if this is possible. Thanks. Well, she's speaking directly to Free Radio here. Let me just give you her phone number, area code 510. Her name is Joanna. Area 510-860-6586. Talking directly to Free Radio, I'm just going to treat this as the public service announcement that it is. We're having a Roots Reggae Showcase at the Blue Lagoon tonight, Saturday. We'd like to give away two tickets for entry to your listeners. Whether or not that's been done or not, I take that to mean a limit of two tickets, but I may be wrong. Please call Joanna at 510-860-6586. Here's another one. A press release. The 31st annual Mother's Day Run for Shelter is Sunday, May 10th. That's May 10th now, next month, Sunday, May 10th, at Ramsey Park in Watsonville. The event is for competitive runners, weekend joggers, and walkers. It starts at 7 a.m. and finishes in time to take mom to brunch, May 10th. Sign up and help benefit Pajaro Valley Shelter Services in their mission to help families experiencing homelessness. To register, go to pvshelter.org. That's pvshelter.org. Actually, that was the introductory remark to the press release. Here is the press release, or a press release. 31st Annual Mother's Day Run for Shelter, Pajaro Valley Shelter Services Benefit Fundraiser, where Ramsey Park, 1301 Main Street, Watsonville. Main Street is certainly easy to find, right off the highway there. 1301 Main Street, Watsonville, Sunday, the 10th of May, 7 to 11 a.m. First race starts at 7:45. Online race registrations. Ready to copy this down? Online registration, www.pvshelter.org. Likewise, http://www.pvshelter.org. Or call this number, area 831-728-5649, extension 107. Pajaro Valley Shelter Services, run walk for shelter, and a 1K kids fun run. Goodies include t-shirts, roses for mothers, medals for winners, continental breakfast, and a live DJ. This year, families with strollers will be allowed in the event. For 31 years, the community of Watsonville has supported PV Shelter's Mother's Day run to ensure the continuation of services for homeless families. The first race was held in 1984 and raised $8,000. With a small crowd in attendance, $8,000. This year we expect over 600 participants and 100 volunteers and spectators to help raise $100,000. Whew. Quite a difference. This well-loved event can be enjoyed by attendees of all ages and skill levels, from the competitive runners to the weekend joggers to families who want to walk together. Starting and ending in Ramsey Park, the race route is a beautiful trek around Watsonville's Slough Trails. Start your Mother's Day off by joining the community and supporting the end of homelessness for mothers, their children, and families in South County. The first race starts at 7:45, and the entire event ends at 10 a.m., just in time to enjoy the rest of Mother's Day. Brunch time, the 10K and 5K races will be professionally timed. Mother's Day run has become a tradition. For many, there are three generations who do the run walk together and then go to brunch afterwards. Three generations. It's a great family tradition to help end homelessness on Mother's Day. PVSS Executive Director Kimberly Firm, Community Support PV Shelter, has the recipe for successfully changing the lives of families experiencing homelessness by giving them the tools to help themselves. The Mother's Day Run for Shelter is PV Shelter's biggest fundraising event. The race walk is an opportunity for the community to partner with PV Shelter to raise funds so we can continue our mission of promoting self-sufficiency and changing the lives of families experiencing homelessness. Something about this PSA strikes home with the material I'm reading from Anna Balcher's book, Homelessness, Statelessness, Being Treated Like You Don't Exist. Okay, and that's essentially it. The course is certified. Computerized time results will be announced and on the website. All runs and walks start and end at Ramsey Park. Run and walk courses are different this year. Course maps are available at pvshelter.org. Go to pvshelter.org for more information and for your online race registration. P as in Paul, V as in Victor, shelter.org, pvshelter.org. Okay. Let's get to it. Let us do it. as they say. Fun time's over. It's back to the book. I'll turn the phone lines, the ringers off here. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show, the Saturday edition. This April 11th, 2015. It's 12:01 in the afternoon. My name is Ren Tawil, your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American, seeking peace and justice for all involved. Reading from Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish American woman in the occupied territories. Tuesday, April 19, 2005, back in Yanun. I have just returned to Yanun. I was here once before, and I would have liked it to be different this time, but it's not. Settler trailers still tower above the village in all directions, forming an almost unbroken chain that continues to choke the dwindling community of Palestinian farmers and shepherds. The nearest settlement, Itamar, is a full 4 miles away, but several of its illegal outposts are within a stone's throw of tiny Yanun. Settlers in the area are known for their support of Kach, a Jewish extremist group sharing its origins with Kahane Chai. Illegal and underground since 1994, when member Baruch Goldstein massacred 29 Palestinians in Hebron, Koch advocates creating, and I quote, conditions of a negative magnet that will bring the Arab population to prefer to emigrate, end quote. Koch says so. The translation, they'll do whatever they can to get the Palestinians out. Sponsored by Israeli and U.S. tax dollars, settlers have been coming down the hills into Yanun for several years, terrorizing the local population in unimaginable ways. Since a series of particularly violent attacks on farmers and their land forced inhabitants to flee in late 2002, there has been a constant international and or Israeli activist presence in Yanun. While the presence may be psychologically comforting to the families who have returned to their homes, it has not been fully effective at preventing settler raids and attacks, which continue to this day. At night, the bright lights of the outpost shine down on the quiet village. I am watching them glare down now, so harsh in the rural setting. I have just returned from dinner with old friends whom I remembered from last year, a young girl and her niece, both 11 years old. I recognized one immediately, and they welcomed me into the house. Their mother, Hanai, immediately invited me to stay for dinner and scolded me for buying vegetables in Akraba that day when I should have known her home and food were mine as well. We took a walk around the house towards the fields, and the girls competed to see who could pick me the largest and juiciest cactus stem, a delicacy I had never tried before. They labored over the prickly skin and left me with the fruit. Hani offered me a cup of tea. I asked that she make it without sugar, to which she replied, "Are you sick too?" Hani, like many Palestinians, is diabetic. But she continues to cater to the sweet tooths of her husband and children. She eventually returned to cooking while I hung out with the girls outside. Suddenly an army jeep drove up with its lights on. My heart skipped a beat, but the girls remained unfazed. I guess children around here either live in constant fear or become fearless. Back at the Yanun International House, I have been reading letters and literature written by the settlers of Itamar and its outposts. It seems the settlers around here are nothing short of fanatics carrying out a violent campaign to ethnically cleanse the area of Palestinians. They believe that this land belongs to the Jews, and always has, and that future generations of Israelis will look back on the settlers' sacrifices to, quote, save their promised land with pride and honor. The villagers of Yanun are also thinking about future generations. Many families have come back because they fear that if they leave now, neither they nor their children will ever be able to return. They do not want to repeat the mistake of their elders in 1948, many of whom evacuated for fear of being attacked, expecting to return home shortly. They were never allowed back, however, and now their homes lie buried under the State of Israel. The settlers around Yanun are something else. They are currently aiming to raise more than $3.5 million U.S. dollars for settlement, quote, needs, such as bulletproof cars, trained guard dogs, and a petting zoo. We're talking about the Jewish settlers surrounding the Arab village of Yanun. They have sent out appeals on the web. All donations to this settlement are tax-deductible for U.S. taxpayers, another testimony to the marriage between right-wing settlers and the Israeli and American governments. The illegal outposts The illegal outposts around Yanun have already gone from nothing to being equipped with a water tower, a fish farm, concrete buildings, and electricity. Avri Ron, the infamous settler terrorists who beat up my Israeli friend David, has built an extensive free-range chicken farm and organic farm on the land he stole from villagers in Yanun. He sells the chickens' eggs throughout Israel with the, quote, free-range label. What a bizarre choice for conscientious Israeli consumers. Should they support free-range chickens or free-range Palestinians? I was supposed to come to Yanun with a colleague, but a last-minute emergency kept her in Haris. So I am the only foreigner in the village. Normally, this would not bother me. On the contrary, I enjoy being the only foreigner. But here it means that there will be much less effective should anything happen. And I am also more vulnerable. If they would rip a fellow Israeli's nose apart, what would they do to me? I am afraid. I am afraid that the settlers will come down to the village tonight and I will not be able to prevent or deter them. I am afraid they will beat me if I try to stop them, and I am afraid I will not be able to keep myself from confronting them. I am afraid, and yet I'm glad that I'm here, and not safe at home watching television. I know I am where I am supposed to be, and something about the fear makes me feel present and alive. Still, I am taking a gamble. I could get hurt, but I could also mean the difference between a situation escalating and calming down. Is this a gamble worth taking? Or am I as crazy as some people say I am? My friend Luna helped me answer these questions by setting me straight. Luna said, "Don't overestimate your importance in this struggle. Your presence is not helping end the occupation in any significant way. But here's my perspective. I gave up on a world peace a long time ago. Humanity is doomed one way or another. The question is, where do I want to be on the sinking ship? I can't live a normal life knowing that this injustice is going on, and I could have been here as a witness and a worker, small as my role may be. So that's my answer. I hate this, but I'm so grateful to be here." I have a bit more optimism left in me than Luna, but otherwise her words echo my sentiments. I'm here because I could not stand to be anywhere else. Reading from Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine. Thursday, April 21. Young men targeted for arrest. Well, I made it back from Yunnan and then through my toughest day yet in Palestine alive, just barely. Yesterday I went down to Safa, where the village council had invited internationals and Israelis to document recent destruction in the area. Our small group walked the short way from the village to the bulldozers and then along the path, commenting on the irony of our approach, of our privilege to approach the threatened trees, while their owners would risk being shot or arrested if they came half as close. We stopped to rest in an olive grove along our hike, and three soldiers approached us to ask what we were doing. Actually, they wanted to know what the two Palestinians with us were doing and demanded to see their IDs. They wrote down the ID numbers. I asked if our friends would be punished for going to their land. The soldier ignored me. Picture of a soldier taking note of which Palestinians were showing internationals around the wall construction in the village. Sometimes being on a list is all it takes to be harassed, interrogated, or imprisoned. Continuing now with the text. Our group walked solemnly back to the village, where we found a standoff between the young boys throwing stones and the army shooting rubber bullets and tear gas into the village. We didn't know how it had started, but it was clear that neither side wanted to back down. The young boys wanted the soldiers out of their village, and the soldiers wanted the boys to stop throwing stones toward the army. Towards the army. And footnote here, I use the word towards instead of at because, as I've mentioned before, stone throwers rarely get close enough to soldiers to actually hit them. I'm never going to forget that. Let me repeat that, because we hear so much about boys, youths, Palestinians throwing stones at soldiers, generally the only weapon of any caliber that they have. Balzer writes, the young boys wanted the soldiers out of their village, and the soldiers wanted the boys to stop throwing stones towards the army. Footnote, I, Anna Balzer, author here, use the word towards instead of at because, as I've mentioned before, stone throwers rarely get close enough to soldiers to actually hit them. Now let's continue. I understand the village boys' dilemma. If they were the first to back down, the army would have succeeded in declaring their land a, quote, closed military zone, that is, off limits to Palestinians. I found it harder to understand the soldiers who kept yelling at me and my Israeli friends to move out of the way so they could shoot at the boys. Obviously, if the soldiers really wanted the kids to stop throwing stones, they would just leave the village. This wasn't a demonstration. These were kids who ran out of their houses when they saw the soldiers coming. The soldiers were trying to show the boys who was in charge. Things started to become very heated, and two Israeli activists stepped out into the path of crossfire to deter the soldiers from shooting. The young soldiers were noticeably annoyed. The village boys stopped throwing stones so that the two Israelis would not be hurt. After a brief conversation with the activists, the soldiers turned to leave, and the village youth let out a great cheer. They felt they had won. Several young boys began to throw stones at as the soldiers left, until they were out of sight. But they never got out of sight. They got mad. The soldiers ran back towards the village and started shooting wildly. I instinctively ran into the area of crossfire. Listen to that, folks. Author says, that she instinctively ran into the area of crossfire, not away from it, but into it, and began waving my hands in the air and screaming as loud as I could, "Don't shoot." A bullet flew over my head and hit a branch above me. Several leaves fell on my head. My heart skipped a beat, and I choked back a sob. Most of the young men ran away as the soldiers approached, except for a gutsy few who continued throwing stones. One waited too long, and a soldier jumped out from the side and grabbed him around his neck, pulling him away. His face turned bright red, and I was afraid he would choke. The soldiers then left quickly with the young man, having gotten what they wanted. Now they had won. Did you hear what I said, folks? The soldiers then left quickly with the young man. They kidnapped the young man. This was back in 2005. As soon as villagers realized what had happened, they started to scream, running after the soldiers en masse. A woman who had been watching from her house ran out onto the balcony and began to wail. It was her nephew who had been led away by the soldiers. The woman, her sister, and all the young men ran after the captured villager until another group of soldiers stopped them from going any further. The group watched, horrified, as their friend stumbled to keep up with the soldier dragging him by his neck until he was behind the trees and out of sight. The crying woman would not be held back. They pushed their way past the soldiers, who are in general far more tolerant of aggressive women than confrontational men, and I followed. We ran down a steep path and slid off a steep drop onto the path of the wall, where the young man was being held on the ground with his hands tied behind his back. His name was Muhammad. The women ran to him and began prying the soldier's hands off him, trying to free him from their grip. The soldier in charge told the women to leave, and one woman responded by kissing his hand and begging him to let Muhammad go. Muhammad yelled at his aunt to leave. I didn't know why until he turned his head, and I saw that he could not bear to hear her cries. His strong face had broken into tears at the sight of her. I asked the soldiers what they were doing, and they said Muhammad was being arrested. I asked why, and they said, for throwing stones. I saw one sensitive-looking soldier and pulled him aside. Quote, look, I know this young man was throwing stones, and I know that's scary for you, but you have to understand that you are invaders in his village, protecting the people, stealing his land. How would you react if someone came into your house with a gun and started carrying out your TV, and then your stereo, and then your bed? Wouldn't you throw a lamp at him or something? The soldier listened to me, and I appreciated that. But then another soldier told him to stop talking to me and to take Muhammad into the jeep. I stood in front of the jeep doors, holding on to them to physically prevent the soldier and captured villager from entering. I continued speaking. Please think about what you're doing. You have the power to let him go or to ruin his life. Do you really think imprisoning him is going to prevent the boys from throwing stones in the future? What are you trying to accomplish? The more aggressive soldier came from the side and yanked me out of the way. The soldier and Muhammad got into the jeep. I went around to the side to keep talking, and I saw Muhammad's face. He was covered in sweat, miserable, hopeless. I asked him what his full name was and wrote it down for the arrest report. Then I asked him if he wanted me to deliver any message to his parents, and he just looked down. I felt like a jerk, just for being there, for witnessing his humiliation and despair. Several more Israeli activists began to approach, and I asked one of them to translate for me because two of the soldiers said they didn't speak any English. The activists said it wasn't any use, but I insisted, perhaps more for my sake than anyone else's. I turned to the soldier in the passenger seat. "Do you think this young man is a threat to Israeli security?" He nodded. "Do you think that imprisoning this young man will secure Israel?" He nodded again. I pointed towards his family sitting and crying nearby. "How do you think this will affect them? Do you think his brothers and cousins will grow up to be suicide bombers or peacemakers?" The soldier understood my point, and he didn't want to hear it, but he didn't want to hear it or respond. As he shut the door in my face, I hurried, saying, "You've got one guy, but you're making 1,000 more enemies." The driver started the engine of the Jeep, and my friend and I ran in front of it, refusing to move. I gave my card of digital photographs from that day to another friend in case I was arrested. We agreed we weren't moving until Mohammed was released. The driver stopped the engine, annoyed, and got out. I could see Mohammed's face watching. I could see the sensitive soldier reflecting. Several soldiers were discussing something. After several minutes, my Israeli friend Kobe called me over, away from the soldiers, and we turned around to watch together. The soldiers were opening the back door and came out, and out came Mohammed. A soldier untied his hands and handed him back his ID. The women watching behind me stood up slowly with joy and amazement. Mohammed walked quickly and calmly back to his family, who smothered him with kisses. On the way, he looked over to me and mouthed the word Toda, meaning thank you, in Hebrew. He thought I was Israeli. We both smiled. Several pictures here of the events and circumstances surrounding this episode. Continuing. Starting with a full-color picture. Graffiti scrawled on a wall. Misspelling the word Israel. "Israeli government, you create hatred." In English, obviously. That graffitiized wall is in Bilin Village, the center of popular resistance against the occupation. Continuing now with the text. Mohammed walked up to the village ahead of us, and before long I heard an incredible cheer erupt in the village. He was home. I allowed myself a moment of happiness at the drop of victory against an ocean of defeats. But I was sobered up soon enough. After a cup of tea, we were on the way to a demonstration in nearby Bilin, where 8 people had already been shot with rubber bullets, including 1 Israeli and 1 journalist. Nobody was seriously injured, but then the protest was still young. Footnote to that statement, rubber bullets are normal bullets with a thin coat of rubber around them. They are easily capable of killing someone, despite their name, rubber bullets. The demonstration had started out as a children's parade of young girls and boys marching with banners. But by the time we arrived, only 1 young boy remained. He was building a roadblock by himself out of odds and ends in the village, hoping it would prevent the army from raiding his village that night. He was too young to realize it, but he was practicing creative nonviolent resistance. As I watched the boy, my eyes began to sting. Tear gas. I squatted down, covering my face. A man nearby yelled at me not to touch my eyes with my fingers. He said I was only pushing it in further. He was more experienced than I at being gassed. And he was right. I recovered and decided I was ready to go home. Then suddenly a jeep pulled up in front of us, and out jumped two soldiers who ran into the forest where the young boys had regrouped. Within seconds, the soldiers reemerged, pulling another young man, this one bigger and more resistant than the boy in Safa. I rushed towards them, and the man began to tell me that he didn't know what was happening, that he hadn't done anything wrong. He asked me to help him. I recognized the soldiers from Safa and suspected that this was another attempt at, quote, winning the game. If the young man had been, quote, wanted, they wouldn't be hunting him during a stone-throwing standoff. I instinctively threw myself between the young man and the soldier who was holding him by his neck. I tried to position myself in such an awkward way that the soldier would have to stop walking or it would hurt me. It worked. Kobe came next to me and began to use his body to separate the young man from the standing soldiers, meanwhile talking to them in Hebrew. The soldiers held on tight, and the man's face turned redder as the grip around his neck tightened. He yelled out, and in a burst of energy somehow ripped himself away, freed for a few seconds. This was his chance. A soldier was about to lunge for him, so I grabbed the soldier's arm and screamed, "Run!" I don't know what came over me, but the young man ran. The soldier shook me loose after a few moments, and I began to chase the young man who was running like crazy, so scared that he didn't look where he was going. In his path lay a cliff several meters high, separating one terrace of olive trees from another. In his frenzy, he didn't realize the depth of the cliff and ran off it, knocking his head against a sharp branch and falling hard on his back onto a huge rock. Everyone froze. The young man began to release an almost inhuman moan. I ran to the cliff's edge and looked over to find him lying spread eagle with blood all over his face. I turned around and scaled over the cliff and knelt in front of him. I heard his friend say that everything was going to be okay. I repeated the encouragement, although I was not so optimistic. I asked the injured young man his name, and he responded, "Fadi." I sat with him until a medical team arrived and took him away in a stretcher with the help of several villagers and Israeli activists. When he was gone, I realized that the army was gone, too. One look at him over the cliff's edge, and they had left, as stunned as the rest of us. I was sure Fadi would be paralyzed, if not worse. I looked down at my hand that he had grabbed in desperation. Now would he spend the rest of his life in a wheelchair? I tried to remember the feeling of joy I had experienced just a few hours before, but it was gone. I needed to see Fadi to make sure he was all right. I hitched a ride with Fadi's cousin to the hospital in Ramallah, and 30 minutes later we were rushing into the emergency room. We found Fadi all bandaged up, but conscious and standing with help. He smiled when he saw me come in. I asked how he was, and he closed his eyes and said, "Alhamdulillah," implying that he was all right. I asked his father, standing near his bedside, what the doctors had said, and he repeated, "Alhamdulillah." Fadi was pretty banged up, but he was going to be okay. I asked where it hurt, and he pointed to his leg. I asked about his back and head, and he pointed to an open wound in the latter where he said a bullet had grazed the bridge between his eyebrows. Had I missed a gunshot in the chaos, or was he embellishing the tale? My answer was the same regardless, saying, "Alhamdulillah, thank God." He smiled again. It's 12:30 noon. This Saturday, April 11, 2015. And again, we are reading from entries from April 2005. Anna Baltzer is writing about events in villages located at or close to the so-called security wall, indeed the apartheid wall, separating Israel proper from the Palestinian land which Israel's military illegally holds, occupies severely. In the West Bank, of the Jordan River, between the river and the State of Israel, in 10 years ago, the year that Hamas came to power in the Gaza Strip, which of course is the other end of Palestine, what should be free Palestine. Indeed, and no, I'm sorry, that 2005 was the year, later that year, this is April, when the Jewish settlements were all vacated, dismantled, and removed from the Gaza Strip, more for public relations purposes than for anything else. And, of course, those Jewish settlers simply moved to, most of them, to newer settlements and expanded settlements in the West Bank. Same story. Same illegal occupation of another part of Palestine. Still ends up suppressing and displacing native Palestinian Arabs. It was the next year, 2006, when Hamas came to power in the Gaza Strip. And 2 years after that, in 08, the summer of 2008, I happened to take my activist human rights trip sailing into the port of Gaza City. 4 months after that, Israel invaded the Gaza Strip. During an election year, only weeks before the national election, which returned Bibi Netanyahu to political power in Israel, same was true in November of 2012, another purely political stunt, killing a couple of thousand Arabs so that Netanyahu could return to power. And of course, we all know what happened last summer. Three slaughters of Palestinian Arabs in the course of 6 years. And how many Israelis have been killed by mortars and rockets that come out of the Gaza Strip in Israel in the last 15 years, since the beginning of the new millennium? How many Israelis have died in the course of some 15 years? Fewer than 30. We're looking at the deaths of roughly 5 or 6,000 Palestinian Arabs in three terrible massacres committed by the so-called Israeli Defense Forces. 5 to 6,000 deaths and no more than 30 Israelis killed by nuisance bombings. In case you're wondering, those rockets and mortars that come out of the Gaza Strip and land in Israel are considered by international law to be, on the one hand, an exercise in war crimes. It is a breach of international law, international agreement, for the Gazan rockets, most of which are launched not by Hamas directly, but by Hamas splinter groups. That is considered a war crime. Just as the many overwhelming and brutal overkill of the recent three Israeli slaughtering invasions of the Gaza Strip. That, too, is filled with many instances of out-and-out war crimes. I'm only telling you this. I'm not reading from the book now, obviously, but I want people to know. And this is assuming that anyone has any respect for me to begin with, for the fact that I'm doing this program, for the fact that I'm reading from this book. Even though Gazan rockets killing Israelis is also considered a crime against humanity, a war crime, I don't care to repeat that anymore, particularly given the circumstances that I'm reading about the Arabs living in the West Bank. Because traditionally, which is to say going back to 1967, the year when Israel invaded the Gaza Strip and kept it for themselves until 05, and they still exercise enormous control over its borders and over the lives of those non-Jewish people living there. So in my eyes, Israel has never fully relinquished control by any means of Gaza. It has been known generally that circumstances for the Gazan Palestinians are far worse than those in the West Bank. How dare anyone criticize the Gazans for doing anything to protect their interests? To use armed struggle to try to make the Israelis think twice about the way they're treating them. And it seems as though we here in the West, in the United States, only hear about these terrible rockets that come out of Gaza. How often do we hear about the details, the daily, the very real details of life for Palestinians living under occupation? And yes, that includes Gaza, because Gaza is still in de facto occupation. This according to the United Nations, by the way these things are defined by international law. All right. Alhamdulillah, thank God, he smiled again. It's 12:38 a.m. Let's continue now with Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories by Anna Balzer. Friday, April 22nd, 2005. Sick man detained at Huwara checkpoint. After saying goodbye to Fadi and his family yesterday, I took a shared taxi to Zatara checkpoint, where I received a call that a sick man named Jabbar was being held at Huwara checkpoint, a few miles north. She's at Zatara, he at Huwara checkpoint. When I arrived, I found Jaber and his wife waiting in the dark in a detention area next to the checkpoint. Jaber was clutching his stomach and coughing violently. When Jaber's wife saw me, she sprang up and called out that her husband was very sick. I learned that he had been hospitalized in Nablus for over a week with serious chest and stomach problems, and he was on his way home to his village shortly after noon when the soldiers stopped them at the checkpoint. It was past 10 o'clock p.m. when I arrived. The couple had been held waiting for 9.5 hours. Jaber looked like he was ready to pass out. The soldiers at the checkpoint yelled at me to stop talking to the detainees, but I ignored them. One soldier came over and asked who I was. I answered that I was a friend of the wife's uncle, which is true, and that I had come when I heard that her sick husband had been held without explanation or charge for more than 9 hours. I asked the soldier why they were holding him so long, and he said they'd tell me alone, away from Jaber and his family. I told the soldier that I would not leave my friends and that I was afraid to talk to him alone. I said his gun and illegitimate power in the situation made me uncomfortable. I think it's not a bad idea to remind soldiers that they are the biggest threat to my safety in the West Bank after the settlers. They commit far more crimes in the area than Palestinians and have caused more serious injury to internationals than anyone else. The settlers have. Jewish settlers have. The soldier said he didn't know why Jaber was being held, but he was sure it was for a good reason. I was unconvinced. Meanwhile, Jaber had kneeled over and was coughing. His wife was beside herself. I told the soldiers that Jaber needed a doctor, and they responded by saying they were taking him away. Jaber's wife began to cry. I stepped in front of Jaber and his wife to block the soldiers, who were coming with handcuffs. A relative asked if it was really necessary to handcuff a man in such agony, and they agreed not to. They pushed me and Jaber's wife aside and threw him into a jeep. Jaber's brother, who was standing with us, told me to let it go, that it was too late now. We all walked back to the car in silence except for Jaber's wife, who continued to sob. As we were walking away, two soldiers started chuckling, and I turned to them. Don't tell me you think this is funny. One soldier yelled out to me, "You're just a little girl. You can't do anything." I turned and yelled, "I'm older than you, asshole," and felt ashamed immediately. It was the first time I had sworn in front of Palestinian friends. I apologized, and they forgave me instantly. They thanked me repeatedly, which made me feel uncomfortable. This time, I hadn't been able to help, and for all we knew, Jaber was on his way to interrogation. I called the Army's Humanitarian Office for information, but as usual, their, quote, Army side was more pronounced than their, quote, humanitarian one. They would not tell us why Jaber was arrested or why he had been held at Hawara for so long, and when he would be able to contact his family, or when he would be able to contact his family. They knew, but they wouldn't tell us. I told them that where I come from, you aren't supposed to hold people without charge. I asked if Jaber had a lawyer, and they didn't understand the question. Most Palestinians don't get lawyers or a fair trial. The army rules according to its best interests. Jaber's family and I drove together to the home of Jaber's parents-in-law in Marta, and we drank tea under the moon. After perhaps the longest day of my life, it was finally time to go to sleep. But somehow I wasn't tired anymore. I just sat there, thinking, watching the tired but resilient faces around me. One belonged to a good friend who invited me to stay the night with his family. I accepted. When I woke up the next morning, he announced that the family was throwing me a going-away party. I refused, but he insisted. It is moving to know that I will be missed, and I am already wondering not if but when I will be back there. The truth is, I may be leaving Palestine in a week, but mentally I won't be leaving Palestine for a long time. I know how hard it will be to readjust to normal life and social interactions. Most people don't want to talk or think about the atrocities that are being supported by their own government and permitted by their own apathy or inaction. Politically straightforward dialogue can be very socially awkward, and I know it will be a while before I can relate to most Western people of privilege in a normal way. But the readjustment is not what scares me most. What I dread above all lies after I adjust, when I begin to forget. I know it will happen. Of course, I will keep Palestine in the back of my mind, but at the forefront will be my job, my boyfriend, and all the daily trivia that prevents most people from doing more to help those in need. And once I've slipped back into my ordinary way of doing things, what will make me different from the Israeli soldiers who served because refusing would be too costly? I find inaction appalling in others, but most of all in myself. After all, like those Israeli soldiers and inactive citizens, or the Germans who remained silent during the atrocities in World War II, those with power and privilege are always, to some degree, responsible for that which they could help prevent, but choose not to. Sunday, April 24. Jewish emancipation and Palestinian imprisonment. Friday night, we hosted our first official IWPS Passover Seder in Palestine. Balcher notes that a Seder is a Jewish ritual feast on the first evening of Passover. Passover, a Jewish holiday celebrating self-determination and freedom from oppression, never meant much to me in the past, but this time was different. We invited Palestinian neighbors, Israeli activists, and other internationals to celebrate with us, and also to mourn the brutal oppression that continues today. Hannah handed out copies of an alternative Haggadah, including the 10 plagues of the occupation, in addition to the traditionally referenced 10 plagues inflicted upon the Egyptians by God. Further footnoting here, the Haggadah is the book traditionally read aloud during the first nights of Passover. It recounts the story of Jews enslaved by Egypt's Pharaoh and then liberated following a series of plagues inflicted upon the Egyptians by God. The alternative Haggadah we used was based on the, quote, "Love and Justice in Times of War" Haggadah Zine by Micah Bazant and Dara Silverman, available at uuja.org/holidays/lit/loveandjusticehaggadah.pdf. And the 10 plagues of the occupation of Palestine. Home demolitions, uprooting olive trees, blockades and checkpoints, destruction of villages, administrative detention, the wall, theft of resources, false democracy, erasing histories, and war crimes. That is a footnote, actually, to the unread sentence. I did read the sentence. Hannah handed out copies of the alternative Haggadah, including the 10 plagues of the occupation, in addition to the traditionally referenced 10 plagues inflicted upon the Egyptians by God. Full color picture. What a spread. What a spread indeed. Indeed, IWPS's Passover Seder plate included a Palestinian twist, tabbouleh, or Palestinian flatbread, instead of matzo, fennel instead of maror, and olives to symbolize freedom, peace, and economic security. Let's continue with the entry here. It was hard for our Palestinian guests to understand how any Jews could justify oppressing another people when they have suffered so much in the past. My friends knew the biblical story of Exodus better than I did. It's in the Quran. And we enjoyed comparing stories and interpretations. We talked about the past and the future. We sang songs about freedom. And we ate a lot of good food. The meal had a Palestinian twist to it. Tabbouleh, Palestinian flatbread instead of matzo, fennel instead of maror, and olives in the cedar plate to symbolize freedom, peace, and economic security. Shortly after the cedar ended, there was a knock at the door. It was the sister and cousin of Jaber, the sick man whose arrest I had witnessed the night before. They were in tears, desperate to know of his condition. I had called the army's, quote, humanitarian office earlier that day to learn that Jaber had been seen by one of the army doctors, who are infamous for ignoring injuries and illnesses if doing so protects or facilitates the work of the army. The doctor's diagnosis? Sensitivity in the chest and heart pain, but medical condition does not bar arrest. End quote. That was all. I called physicians for human rights who had barely heard of the case. They said the doctor's diagnosis was bogus, and when pushed, the doctor admitted that Jaber had a stomach ulcer. I called the Army's District Coordination Office, the DCO, and they assured me that Jaber was receiving the proper medication, ulcer pills and lots of water. They said they were positive he was being properly cared for and told me to stop calling them. They even had someone from the prison call me to say Jaber was fine and well. I asked to talk to him and was told that that was out of the question. When I told Jaber's family that he had an ulcer, they were very confused. This was not at all the diagnosis given by the Nablus doctor in whose care Jaber had been during the past week in the hospital. We called the Nablus doctor, who informed us that Jaber didn't have a stomach ulcer at all. He had meningitis. We began to make phone calls. The DCO was annoyed to hear from us again and assured me that the Army knew of Jaber's meningitis and was caring for him accordingly. That's the same thing you said about him being treated for an ulcer, I replied. Meningitis is a lot more serious, and it's contagious. They have been giving him ulcer pills. He should be in a hospital, not a prison. The doctor in Nablus had released him only because he thought he could heal at home in bed. The official interrupted me. He's fine, I promise. I have personally verified it. Now stop calling us. I wondered how he could make such a promise. Did he really know? This was too much of a risk. Security threats, quote unquote, were usually tortured under interrogation during the first few days under custody, not nursing in bed. Jaber's sister, Samia, was also suspicious. She said he had been arrested over 10 years ago and thrown into jail for 9 months. He had been a student at Beer Zeit University, at the time the most prestigious university in Palestine. She said young Jaber had been innocent, but they had tortured him until he confessed to something. His crime, they said, quote, he was nationalistic and had the intention to do nationalistic actions. What does that even mean? Apparently it meant they could keep him as long as they wanted. Samia asked if she could see the pictures of his arrest. When I showed her the first one on my computer screen, she began to cry. In it you could see Jaber's face, on the verge of tears and passing out as the soldier dragged him to the jeep. I closed the picture quickly, regretting having opened it. Samia said she had lost many people in her life, but nothing this painful or out of the blue. She said she couldn't understand it. He had no political ties. He passed through many checkpoints every day to get to work at the Ministry of Finance in Ramallah, and he had never been stopped before. But Jaber's wife said a soldier had Jaber's number written on his hand when the couple arrived at Huwara checkpoint. They were waiting for him. Someone, somewhere, must have given his name. That's all the Army needs to hold people indefinitely. Hannah and I decided to pull out a call to action, asking Israelis to call the prison or DCO to demand that Jaber see a real doctor and receive genuine medical care. Israeli groups forwarded the appeal to their mailing lists around the world. The result was amazing. People began to call en masse. Since the prison didn't pick up, the DCO's phone line was flooded with calls from over 10 different countries. Each caller demanded that the prisoner named Jaber, who was suffering from meningitis, receive proper medical attention. The DCO staff was irate, but they were left with no choice. With the spotlight on them from around the world, they couldn't afford to risk Jaber's life. Jaber was finally transferred to an Israeli hospital, and as luck would have it, the Jewish doctors were all on leave for Passover, so his physician was a Palestinian with Israeli citizenship. That meant Jaber not only had a doctor, but one he could communicate with. My colleague Hannah went to visit Jaber in the hospital. Here is an excerpt from her report. His room was not difficult to find since it was the only one with a closed door and two armed soldiers sitting outside. They would not let us enter, but we were able to talk to the doctor, who had not yet received any information about Jaber's prior medical situation. He seemed frustrated with the Army's reluctance to share information. The doctor told us he had just done a spinal tap and would soon determine Jaber's illness. The viral meningitis diagnosis was confirmed an hour later. When we entered his room, Jaber was sleeping. I said his name softly and he opened his eyes, and he gave a little moan. I introduced myself, and he greeted me with the customary, "Ahlan wa sahlan." Ahlan wa sahlan, welcome. He started to come to his senses and said he was tired and sick. He kept saying, "Bidi amut," which could be translated as, "I want to die," or "I'm going to die." I'm not sure which he meant. Maybe both. He said the doctor was good, but that if he's taken back to Salem Detention Center, they might as well shoot him. He was in tears as he told us he hadn't eaten, drunk, or slept in 3 days. In Salem, he said they threw him in a small cell with 9 other people and did not let anyone go out to go to the bathroom from 9 at night until 9 in the morning. He spent the next 2 days on the floor in pain. There were no beds, where he said it was extremely cold at night. He told us he lost consciousness 4 times, but didn't sleep at all. Lack of consciousness, apparently, is not the same as sleeping. Continuing. Nobody spoke with him while he was there. So if there is to be any interrogation, it has not yet begun. He told us to lift up the blanket covering his feet, and we saw the metal cuffs on his ankles. He was too weak to sit up or feed himself, and 2 armed guards sat outside his room, but he had to be shackled? While Susie spoke to the soldier about the shackles, I dialed Jaber's wife's number. She picked up and I quickly said, "Hi, Kulud, I'm with Jaber, hold on," and handed him the phone. They talked for a few minutes before the soldiers forced him to hang up. Jaber handed me the phone, thanked me, and smiled for the only time all day. End of Hannah's statement. I see that it is 1 o'clock, the scheduled ending time for Mideast Migraines, the Saturday edition. I'm going to no one here for a subsequent program here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm going to try to finish the next couple of pages, finish this entry. So the DCO is lying after all. They never personally verified Jaber's condition. And Jabra wasn't even given the water that the army was told was most critical to his recovery. Now Jabra is getting food, but it's only a matter of time before he's taken back into custody at Salem. Jabra's story is tragic, but far from unique. According to Amnesty International, Israel violates international human rights standards in its treatment of Palestinian prisoners in various ways, including police brutality, denial of access to a lawyer, and refusal of bail. And indeed, there is a footnote here. Attorney of law Jonathan Kutab reports that, quote, in 98% of the cases, lawyers cannot see Palestinian clients until after they, quote, confess, and judges will accept the, quote, confession at face value, even if the confession is written in Hebrew, a language unknown to the suspect and elicited after threats, psychological pressure, and torture. Associated Press is cited in Chomsky Fateful. Back to the text. Perhaps most... Oh, another footnote regarding the refusal of bail. Israel and the occupied territories, mass arrest and police brutality, Amnesty International 2000. Back to the text. Perhaps most serious is Israel's torture of Palestinian prisoners, a practice that Human Rights Watch found so widespread that, and I quote, Israel's political leadership cannot claim ignorance that ill treatment is the norm in interrogation centers. The number of victims is too large, and the abuses are too systematic, end quote. Tens of thousands of Palestinians were, quote, tortured or severely ill-treated while under interrogation, end quote, during the first Intifada alone. About 20 Palestinian detainees mysteriously died under interrogation and detention during the same period, about 20. According to B'Tselem, nearly 50% of interrogations end up with no charges being pressed or any other steps taken against the detainee. Methods of torture include covering patients' faces with hoods or blindfolds, hanging them by their wrists for long periods, sexual assault, electric shock, and, I quote, binding the detainee's hands to his legs so that his body is bent backwards, exposed and vulnerable to the blows of the interrogators on the face, the chest, the testicles, the stomach. In fact, on all parts of the body, end quote. The San Francisco Chronicle reported one case in which the Israeli abusers took photographs of themselves with their victims, holding their heads by the hair like hunting trophies. Just one of many such incidents, according to Israeli human rights workers. Female prisoners report additional kinds of abuse. Pregnant inmates have been forced to give birth with handcuffs on. Some female prisoners are arrested, humiliated, and photographed as a means of putting pressure on their husbands. Palestinian child prisoners also consistently report being tortured, as well as intimidated, insulted, sexually harassed, and deprived of education and family visits. Just a few weeks ago, a 16-year-old Palestinian from Jerusalem who was released from detention said that Israeli investigators tied his testicles to a thread and pulled it strongly, causing severe pains. He added that they used him as an ashtray, putting out their cigarettes on his skin, and that he was deprived of sleep, movement, and using the toilet. The testimony came after three Israeli border guards confessed to forcing a group of Palestinian minors to eat sand and kiss their boots after being detained for not carrying their IDs. Amnesty also cites Israel's lack of effective investigation following incidents of torture or abuse by soldiers. Quote, more than 80% of investigations of Palestinians' complaints relating to Israeli police violence are closed, more than 80%, end quote. The power to close investigations lies with the army, the very organization being investigated. In a 2001 report, B'Tselem put the percentage of Palestinian complaints effectively ignored even higher at 100%. quotation here, all the investigation files are closed with no action taken. There are soldiers in every army who abuse their power. I don't say that Israelis are worse than most, although rarely are the abusers lauded abroad as, quote, the most moral army in the world. The first problem is that Israeli soldiers have no right to be in the West Bank and Gaza to begin with, yet the armed 18-year-olds enjoy virtually unchecked power over millions of people. The second problem is that Israel has institutionalized these abuses and failed to investigate complaints or allow impartial observers. Luckily, people are watching. Each person who called the DCO on Jaber's behalf last week made an appeal on behalf of justice for prisoners, and it worked. The abuses are many, but so are we. Okay, folks. Join me next week, next Saturday, at 11 a.m. Pacific time. We'll begin the journal entry, Soldier-Free Demonstrations, from this book, Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories, by Anna Balzer, 2007. You may also join me for the weekday edition of Mideast Migraines Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 p.m. on Monday, Pacific Time, Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org, freakradio.org, and broadcasting to the city of Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM. Thank you. And goodbye for now.